Word of mouth.
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 Mike Napoli's three-run double in the first inning of last night's World Series opener put the Red Sox on the path for an 8-1 drubbing of the St. Louis Cardinals at Fenway Park. The Cardinals committed three costly errors and lost star right fielder Carlos Beltran, who injured himself running into Fenway's unusually low right field wall while making a spectacular catch that robbed David Ortiz of a grand slam. That wall is just one of the quirks of Fenway, the old school ballpark that throbbed with Red Sox fans last night. It is one of a few remaining fields in the nation that isn't named for a bank or a drink. Fenway has a personality and a history. Today's Sox fans sit in the same spot where even more raucous fans sat back in 1912 when Fenway Park opened its doors. Glenn Stout tells the story of the idiosyncratic park's construction, christening, and enduring charm in the book Fenway 1912, The Birth of a Ballpark, a Championship Season, and Fenway's Remarkable First Year. We spoke to him last year when the book first came out and pulled it from the archives today, a great day to celebrate Fenway Park. Glenn Stout, welcome.
Thanks very much.
Boston did have a ballpark in 1911, the Huntington Avenue grounds. Why did it need a new park?
Well, the Huntington Avenue grounds, which had been the Red Sox home since the team began, was not owned by the Red Sox. They leased the land, and the grandstand was really small. The owner of the team, John I. Taylor, couldn't sell enough high-priced grandstand tickets for about a dollar and a half. It only seated about 2,000 people, and sometimes as many as 5,000 would show up and leave because they couldn't sit underneath the stands. They didn't want to go out with the rabble who only paid 50 cents or a quarter. So they needed a ballpark with a bigger grandstand. They also needed one that they could get insurance for, because the old ballparks were built out of wood and wood tended to burn, and insurance companies didn't want to insure them anymore. So they went with this new concrete and steel construction.
Besides giving us the players, the actual players like Tris Speaker, Hick Cady, Duffy Lewis, what a bunch of names, and the fireballer, Smokey Joe Wood, we get the owners, investors, and largely unsung James McLaughlin. Give us a little background on this city architect who designed Fenway Park.
Yeah, that was something I really had some questions about, because 25 years ago, I wrote the 75th anniversary of the park for the Red Sox yearbook and knew nothing about the architect, James McLaughlin. So this time around, I decided to find out about him. And it turns out he was Nova Scotian. He moved here with his mother after his father died, became an architect, very much self-trained. And Fenway Park was the only ballpark he ever built. Before he built Fenway, he was best known for building schools and armories and other civic buildings, taking advantage of the fact that the Irish had taken over city government in Boston, and suddenly those contracts were open to someone like McLaughlin. And so he was given the charge to build Fenway Park. And one of the reasons why Fenway still works and still fits in Boston is it's very much in feeling with many of his other buildings, which are ubiquitous throughout eastern Massachusetts. And so Fenway looks like it fits Boston because McLaughlin was one of those architects that created the look that Boston had.
And some of your myths that you bust through here, many people today attribute the size of the park to having been shoehorned into the surrounding area. It was basically an open space.
Yeah, it was an open space. And what you have to keep in mind is when the ballpark was built in 1912, the game of baseball was much smaller. The game did not reach the borders of the property. Over time, in the Lively Ball era, the game expanded, and over time, the ballpark was built inward. That's why the game is a little small for the park now. But when Fenway Park was first built, no one ever thought someone would ever hit a ball over the left field wall.
Well, on April 9th, 1912, Fenway opened its doors. Some of the notable things that I thought were quite funny, the extravagant two toilet rooms beneath the grandstand, one for the ladies, even.
Yeah, imagine that. Ladies are not only allowed to attend, but are allowed to go to the bathroom at the ballpark.
Well, now people adore these eccentric features of Fenway and look at it like a Renaissance cathedral or something. Did 1912 fans have have the same appreciation?
They started to have the same appreciation. I mean, they were wowed initially by the size of the ballpark. They couldn't believe that the grandstand was as big as it was, I mean, compared to the old Huntington Avenue grounds. But then again, it also took a while to grow on them because the ballpark was kind of stuck out by itself in this area of town that people weren't accustomed to going to. There weren't the bars and restaurants nearby like there is now, you know. Mm-hmm. That all had to develop. And so it took a while for people to latch on to Fenway Park. But, I mean, that's the unique thing about a ballpark is that each time you go to it, you become a little bit of an owner of it. You get some ownership in it. And over time, that's what happened to Boston fans.
Well, it soon became clear that the ballpark was too small in that thrilling 1911-1912 season. Mostly the intense rivalry between the Red Sox Smokey Joe Wood, pitcher, and the young ace of the Washington Senators. This was Walter Big Train Johnson. Their rivalry really put Fenway first to the test. Give us a snapshot of that melee.
Absolutely. They met on September 4th, 1912, in a matchup that fans all across the country looked forward to because both Joe Wood and Walter Johnson had great pitching streaks that year. Johnson's had just ended. Woods was still ongoing. They were widely considered the two best pitchers of the year, the best pitchers of the era. And the Washington manager threw down the gauntlet and challenged Joe Wood to pitch opposite Walter Johnson on this game on September 4th. So many fans turned out at Fenway Park that day that not only did they line up in the outfield, which they often did with overflow crowds, and sit atop the left field wall and on advertisements that were on the left field wall, but they poured onto the infield. They took over the dugouts and ended up watching the game within about 20 feet of the foul lines. The players...
And they kept selling tickets.
That's right. You can't stop selling tickets if people want to come to the ballpark. The players actually watched the game while sitting on the ground like Sandlot kids. It was a terrific game. Joe Wood won 1-0. And as the park emptied, Red Sox management realized one thing. Fenway Park, less than a year old, was already too small. Mm.
So after that, it underwent its first renovation, actually, while the 1912 season was underway, and even just before the World Series.
Right.
And I guess there's no spoiler alert here. Everybody knows that the Red Sox actually did win an epic 8-game World Series.
Oh, absolutely.
So what role did the park play in that win?
Well, it was hugely important because after that game we just talked about, in 2.5 weeks, they added another 11,000 seats. And what that did was fully enclose Fenway Park for the first time and gave Fenway Park the familiar footprint that the park has now. Stands were extended down the left field line. The center field bleachers were connected to the right field stands by the right field bleachers. And sort of by accident, they created this odd footprint that Fenway has. The stands were still so far out that the shape was really of no concern. But what happened during the World Series that year is because they added these extra seats, for example, in left field, they put bleacher seats on Duffy's Cliff, mm-hmm. the retaining wall before the left field wall. They had to institute special ground rules. So if a ball was hit into the stands over there, it was a ground rule double. That also meant that if anyone would have hit the ball over the left field wall during the 1912 World Series, it would have been a ground rule double. It wouldn't have been a home run. So it really had a major impact on how the World Series was played. It shortened the outfield. The outfielders were able to play more shallow. So balls that otherwise would have fallen in for hits were caught at the shoe tops or outs.
We're talking about Fenway Park's first year with sports writer Glenn Stout. He's written a biography of that year called Fenway 1912. He's also the author of Red Sox Century and, dare we say, Yankee Century, among many, many other books. Glenn, we really can't resist a penultimate moment, or let's say a victory lap here. This is from a video taken by a member of the crowd. So sitting there in Fenway Park witnessing the final out of the 2004 World Series. It's worth the wait, 80 years. I still get chills listening to that. It's amazing. But you write that Fenway Park played this key role in the fortunes of the Red Sox against the New York Giants. How about 2004?
Well, I think Fenway has always been sort of a secret weapon for the Red Sox. It's just quirky enough that they have a little more experience playing at it that's always helpful. You know, the left fielder knows how to field balls, hit off the left field wall, things like that. And then you have this crowd that's there, fills up the ballpark every night. And one of the things that I realized sort of after this book was written and I've gone around talking to people is a lot of people are Red Sox fans, but there's even a larger constituency of people who are fans of Fenway. Mm. On any given night, Fenway is about half full of people from out of town who may or may not be Red Sox fans, but love Fenway Park. And that's why in the city of Boston, you don't say you're going to see the Red Sox. You say you're going to Fenway.
Yeah, that's right. My dad grew up in Boston, and he went to Boston Latin, just very close to Fenway. Mm-hmm. And he'd get out in the afternoon. He said at that time, the bleacher doors were open. And he'd just walk right in. And he said this was at a time when the Red Sox weren't winning. So it wasn't all that filled up. But he remembers sitting there watching Joe Cronin, Jimmy Fox. Now it's the most expensive park in the country. Will local kids ever have that kind of experience?
Well, you hope that they will. I mean, I hope there are still enterprising kids who sneak into the park, because that's what I did when I first moved to Boston in 1982. They'd abandoned the bleacher gates, the turnstiles, about the third or fourth inning. You know, I argue that Fenway is a place that can change your life because it changed mine. That was one of the reasons why I moved to Boston. And Fenway Park was my introduction to all things Boston, the history of Boston, the city itself, and obviously the Red Sox. Fenway is different for everyone who encounters it, and that's because it's evolved over time, so that the park I first saw in 82 is a different park than the one your father first saw. But if your father and I were sitting across from one another, that starts a conversation, because we've each seen Fenway Park through different eyes at a different time, and that's how Fenway gets kind of knit into the fabric of everyone's life.
Where it began, I can't begin to know, but then I know it's growing strong.
Glenn Stout, sports writer and author of Fenway 1912, The Birth of a Ballpark, A Championship Season, and Fenway's Remarkable First Year. You'll find more in the book and that beloved park at wordofmouthradio.org. Whether or not you're a fan of the Red Sox, if you're listening right now, we hope you're a fan of NHPR. And we're looking for support from the home team during our fall fund drive. By giving what you can, you'll be paying for the listening that you do and keeping shows like this one on the air. Here's how.